The date is May 9th, 1986, and we're watching Short Circuit. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello, and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host...
I'm Colin Stewart.
So, this week we're looking back at May 1986, when the movies and theaters were Psycho 3, Critters, Pirates, Top Gun, Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, and of course our movie for today, Short Circuit, which earned $40.7 million on a $9 million budget.
And as always, we like to remind people, just in case you haven't seen it, this movie is ridiculously old, but just in case, spoiler alert! Yeah. So if you don't want the movie to be spoiled for you, just hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and listen to what we have to say.
Right on. So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "Something wonderful has happened. Number 5 is alive." So we've got an ellipsis in there and an exclamation point. Yeah, something wonderful has happened, dot, dot, dot. Number 5 is alive, exclamation mark. But that may not be the best description, so we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
Alright, so, Short Circuit is the story of an experimental military robot who is struck by lightning, I guess that's something special, and somehow becomes sentient. After escaping the military base, he befriends a young woman who teaches him about the world, and is pursued by his creator who seeks to take the robot back to the lab and reprogram him before the military finds him and destroys him.
So, I know that with Short Circuit... For me, I have trouble separating the first one from the second one. Like, I kind of blend them together. Because I was always such a fan of Number 5. You know, any kid in the 80s, who wasn't? But it's always hard to remember which scenes came in the first one and which ones came in the second one. Because I was a fan of both of them. But for you, Colin, what is your past experience with Short Circuit?
This is a movie that I remember seeing on TV when I was a kid, but I remembered literally nothing about it. Not that there's really much to remember.
No, there really isn't.
It's a pretty basic movie, all things considered. Yeah. But yeah, I couldn't tell you if I'd actually sat all the way through it before.
Yeah, it's basically like a modern day Frankenstein is sort of the general idea of this movie, I'd say. Okay, let's get right into Short Circuit. It's directed by John Badham, who is the director of Saturday Night Fever, Stakeout, Another Stakeout, Bird on a Wire, The Hard Way, Point of No Return. It's produced by Mark Damon, who we talked about in the Never Ending Story, Episode 7, and 9 1/2 Weeks, Das Boot, Lost Boys, Monster, the live-action Jungle Book. He's someone that was an actor in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then sort of moved into producing after that. And it's written by S.S. Wilson, who was also a writer on Batteries Not Included, Ghost Dad, the Bill Cosby comedy from the 80s, Wild Wild West, oh man, he's got some great credits, and also all 6 Tremors movies, plus the TV series. I didn't even know there were 6 Tremors movies.
Yeah, and I knew there was 3, but I thought they stopped.
Yeah.
They should have stopped at 1, to be honest.
Yeah, as soon as Kevin Bacon left, that's when they should have stopped.
It's also written by Brent Maddock, who basically has an identical credit list. He must be just a writing partner of S.S. Wilson, because... Yeah, you look at it and everything is Tremors and Wild Wild West and Batteries Not Included. Like, almost identical IMDb credit list. We open on, and I use heavy air quotes here, high-tech computers, and we watch the manufacturing of the robots at Nova Robotics, and is all being scored with this weird synthetic music?
Space music.
Can you even call it music? It's like bleeps and bloops and...
it's R2-D2's greatest hits.
And so we move on to a war taking place where there's trucks and tanks being blown up with lasers from the robots that we just saw being built. But psych, it's not a real war, but just a demonstration for a crowd. We find that out when we see that one of the trucks is just filled with charred mannequins. And the lasers, not too bad special effects. I thought they didn't look out of place compared to the explosions that were happening in the trucks. Yeah, like, usually you have these really fake-looking lasers and then the practical explosions, but they kind of blended together nicely, in my opinion. We've got a speech at this event that is being given by Dr. Howard Marner, who was in My Cousin Vinny, the Muppet Movie, 11 episodes of Oz, and the voice of Gurgle in Finding Nemo and Finding Dory. I had to look him up. He's the little purple guy with, like, yellow fins. He's one of the guys that's in the fish tank in the dentist's office, but isn't really as cool as most of the other ones that seem to get more screen time. And he's proudly showing off the Strategic Artificially Intelligent Nuclear Transports, or SAINT, and they're showing off all the extra skills that they have, like mixing the doctor a drink. And then the rain clouds move in, so we decide to take the party inside now, and we're taking indoors now, where some robots are being gala waiters for the investors, and the person missing from the festivities is Newton Crosby, the real brains behind the project.
Do you think people back in 1986 like watched this scene and were just like, man, that's going to be the future?
That's the future.
We'll all robots. Have robot butlers and servers.
But, you know, Return of the Jedi already did it with R2-D2 on Jabba's sail ship. We should have already known that this was going to be the future. Howard sends Ben, who is played by Fisher Stevens, to go find Newton Crosby. But this brings us to a segment on the show, a new segment we like to call, Okay, Let's Talk About Ben for a Minute.
Let's talk about Ben.
So, the character Ben Jabatuya, but strangely, in the sequel, he's called Ben Jafferi. So, like, they've even changed his last name. But, yeah, he's played by Fisher Stevens. Originally, Ben in the script was not written as an Indian character, but he ended up being rewritten that way, and Fisher Stevens, who was already going to be playing Ben... I'm a little confused by how everything worked out here.
But... yeah, so I watched this. I literally had to ask my wife as I was watching the movie for probably 15 minutes after Ben shows up. And I was like, is that guy white or is he...
Yeah, I actually read an interview from, I think it was 2015, where Aziz Ansari... yeah. Said that he was always idolized this character growing up because it gave hope for a little Indian kid, as he put it. When Ben was rewritten as Indian, Fisher Stevens was replaced by Bronson Pinchot. Now, it should be noted that neither of these actors is Indian. Bronson Pinchot, of course, is famous for playing Balky from Perfect Strangers, and when he was cast in Perfect Strangers, Fisher Stevens was rehired. But yeah, Fisher Stevens is a self-proclaimed white, skinny Jewish kid from Chicago, is how he refers to himself. And interestingly for this part, Fisher Stevens decided to go method, and he traveled to India to study Hindi and yoga, and was so believable in this role that he was confused in India when this movie was released for a popular Bollywood actor named Javed Jeffrey. They thought it was just a fake name in the credits, this Fisher Stevens. But Yeah, Fisher Stevens has also made a career out of cultural appropriation, it seems, because he's also played Mexican and an Israeli soldier. I guess that's the closest to Jewish.
Well, it's kind of funny because I read an interview with him that was all like, you know, it's like, woe is me, I've been typecast as being playing all these minorities, and I just want to be white.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I bet you know who feels really bad is all those minority actors who didn't get those roles. So.
I would say so. Like, he was even offered a part of an Afghani soldier in Rambo 3. That one he turned down. So, I mean, honestly, I don't know how to feel about this. Like, I think you nailed it by saying that, yes, these roles should have gone to the minority actors of the time. But the fact that he was so believable that he was mistaken in India for an actual famous Indian actor, it's, you know.
One of the things that I thought was so crazy, just like using the 2020 lens, is how acceptable it was for him to take this role. Like, there's not an article that I read from the time this movie came out where it was like, oh, we can't believe that, you know, he would take this role when there's... And
I haven't even seen any recent articles and there where wasn't he's any apologizing recent, yeah. It, yeah.
But there was, like, I read one article and I was just surprised at the level of craft that he went through to create this character. So I just have a quote from, it was from an art, I think it was the LA Times in 91. It was between the two movies, so it was between Short Circuit and Short Circuit 2, and he says, like, you know, he worked with a vocal coach named Robert Easton, who gave him books about India and cassette tapes of various Indian accents. He found several hotels here in Los Angeles owned by Indians, mostly named Patel. They're not related, but they're all from the state of Gujarat in Pakistan.
Oh, so he even went to the lengths of, like, picking a certain region.
Okay.
And then he says, I went to UCLA and I talked to Indian students so I could be as authentic as possible. So it's that, like, you know, it's what you're talking about with, like, method acting, but just the level of acting craft that went into creating this character, and it was accepted, and there was no blowback whatsoever. There's not even any blowback to this day.
No.
I read tons of reviews from critics at the time, even tons of reviews from audience and stuff lately, and it's like, no, but nobody points out the fact that...
No, and we're living in a time where Hank Azaria has decided to stop voicing Apu after 30 years on The Simpsons. Or we're also living in a time where the CW has to recast the role of Batwoman, and they went on this big search to find, like, an actual gay actress instead of finding someone that could just play gay. Like, this is a generation, or a you know, we now live in a time where everyone is looking for more authenticity, and no apologies for Ben.
Add one more thing even with the appearance of the character, he had to grow a beard, he had to dye his hair black, darken his skin with makeup, turn his blue eyes brown with contact lenses, speak with an Indian accent like we talked, and he chose to walk hunched over like a cricket player would. So the guy's gone that in depth.
Wow. I mean,
part of me wants to applaud the commitment.
Yeah, and there's also the upside that the character was written as Indian. Like, this wasn't a character choice. So the blame goes more on the writers of the movie. Like,
but also, I was saying, like, you were saying, the character was originally written to be what, American?
And then
they chose, they wanted to make him either, I think, to go along the lines of, like, the scientist, they wanted to make him either Indian or Chinese. Yeah. They chose Indian.
Well, thank God. If they had kept Fisher Stevens, at least they...
But even that, I'm thinking, like... How far diversity was from the mind of these producers at the time,
sure.
Right? You're like, oh, we take the step, but we want to make a diverse character, but we're not gonna actually cast
diversity. Yeah, because they love the character. They double down, like you said, for the sequel. But yeah, it's just he's so great. Like, he's so hilarious. Like,
I know, the fact that Aziz Ansari didn't realize that that guy was an Indian, basically until he had the internet when he was in college, is, like, the testament to how convincing he is. I wasn't sure.
Exactly. Like, and the things that Ben says, they're absolutely hilarious. He is a very gifted performer, but, yeah, it's just, with this, I'm so torn with Ben because, yeah, it just, we know now this is not cool. This is not acceptable.
But at the same time, you don't have anybody today, like you said, like running to the tallest hill they can find, screaming that, like, we should all boycott Short Circuit. It's a really interesting, it was really interesting watching this movie to me, to think of all the people shit on what's her name, Zoe Saldana, for playing, she played a woman who, she's black, she played a woman who was darker and kind of darkened her skin for the role.
Yeah.
And people were like, oh, like, how could you? And then you have
getting mad at a black actress for doing blackface, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this movie, it seems like, you know, yeah, no one goes, or even if you have people talk, going back as far as John Wayne, who's been dead for however long, and talking about what a racist he was and how bad it was, and saying that his legacy is tarnished and blah, blah, blah.
Wanting to change the name of the airport in California.
But I've heard nobody talk about the issues in this movie in terms of race.
These are beloved movies. And I just, like, I don't even understand. Fisher Stevens and Bronson Pinchot are both very gifted at doing accents and things like that as well. So it's just, why didn't you go for Russian or Polish? Or why didn't you go for, like, Balky on Perfect Strangers? Why didn't you go for some obscure Mediterranean island where it doesn't matter what the accent is? I don't understand why the need. Like, because now, if we're saying it's because he's a scientist, that's why we wanted to make him either Indian or Asian. Well, now you're also just feeding into his stereotype. Yeah. Like,
it's not improving things at all.
Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, considering he fooled an entire country, he's clearly doing a good job. But overall, I'm glad that these days they are fixing mistakes like this. And it would be interesting to see when the backlash on Short Circuit finally happens. How low is it on the list of things people need to protest?
It's also crazy, though, because I bet this is one of those movies, like, in the style of Bill and Ted, where people have been clamoring for another sequel for a long time.
Yeah.
But it just cannot happen with...
No, now
you cannot have Fisher Stevens reprise that role. even for a 1 minute,
even for a cameo.
Yeah. It's...
And that is okay, let's talk about Ben for a minute. Yeah, Ben is sent to find Newton Crosby, and we are now introduced to Newton Crosby, who is in his office, who is played by Steve Guttenberg, who everyone knows him as Mahoney from Police Academy. He was in Cocoon 1 and 2, Three Men and a Baby, Three Men and a Little Lady, It Takes Two with the Olsen Twins, and, of course, the man that the Stonecutters made into a star, if you listen to the song on The Simpsons. But he doesn't really want to hobnob with the investors. He says hobnob, what, 7, 8 times in this movie? Did no one in the writer's room have a thesaurus to find something else for hobnob? Or does the character just not know any other words?
I have to say, his lab, when we find him and he has all those robot arms around him and stuff, it really reminded me, even the way he talks to them reminded me a lot of Iron Man. The first Iron Man movie with his robots and stuff.
With
less high-tech computer equipment around him. We find out that each robot costs $11 million to build, and so we need Newton Crosby up there to talk up these robots and make sure that the investors invest. I was interested to find out. Now, there, I did say in the beginning that it has a $9 million budget. I did find a couple discrepancies in some of my research. And there was one place that I found that said it was a $14 million budget. But this movie actually had 15 of these robots built. Out of this $9 million budget or $14 million budget, whatever it is, $1.4 million went to these robots. That too.
That's crazy.
So they are a little under, but man, like, just for something that's not actually a real robot, but just a glorified puppet.
Yeah.
For them to have spent, you know, a tenth of the budget on these robots, that's quite an investment for this movie. So while the Saint robots are being unloaded from the truck, the storm that had started earlier has now become a thunderstorm, and we get some lightning striking some power lines, and we get the Frankenstein moment of this movie where number five gets... Oh, that's going to happen a million times. I almost said Johnny Five.
Not yet.
Yeah. Where number five gets zapped, and he stops taking orders and ends up wandering off when he's actually supposed to be attending the gala, and he follows some robot tail. One of the waiter robots comes by, and it's got a female voice, and it's got the extension cord dangling from it. So, is it his curiosity, or is this some sort of, like, innuendo that we're dealing with, is him chasing tail?
Yeah, I don't know. But he hasn't learned what love is yet.
So, okay, he's just curious, because number five is a curious robot. So when only four robots show up to the gala, they know he's now missing. Through a series of coincidences, number five manages to get himself out onto a truck and out of the compound. And we've now got security chief Captain Schroeder on the case, who is played by G.W. Bailey, who is also from Police Academy, Lieutenant Harris, the movie Mannequin, and most recently 105 episodes of a show called Major Crimes. I don't know what that show is. It is interesting to see Steve Guttenberg and G.W. Bailey together, though. Again, you know, the whole Mahoney, and they've got a slightly different dynamic in this movie, but G.W. Bailey is basically Lieutenant. Lieutenant Harris.
I watched both of those movies back to back, and it was funny because I was like, he's the same guy. Yeah. He's just very adept at playing militaristic police army
militaristic assholes, yeah, too, but like inept as well at the same time. But he, Newton, Ben, and Howard are all using the computer to triangulate number five's position. I do like the line where Howard says, it's simple, like, why can't you triangulate his position? And Steve Guttenberg or Newton Crosby fires back with, can you triangulate your position, Howard? Yeah, so there's a lot of little one-liners in there that they kind of sneak in, and they come a lot faster than I remember these jokes coming. But number five is malfunctioning, and this is coming up on the screen. He needs input. So it's outside the gates, they find out. And so while the security guys are sent after it, and of course the nerds are all saying, bring it back in one piece, and all the jocks are saying, bring it back by any means necessary. One of the first messages that Johnny Five sends to the computer is, don't you want to be a pepper? Which means it's time for Sponsorship Corner. Now, I appreciate how on the screen that the words that come up are in the correct font, too. So he is sending the Dr. Pepper logo in the correct font. But we've got way more than just that this week. Short Circuit is brought to you by Dr. Pepper, Husqvarna Chainsaws, Valvoline Motor Oil, Pemco Gas, Macintosh Computers, Brawny Paper Towels, Alaskan Airlines, Colgate Toothpaste, Polaroid Cameras, Orida Potatoes, Duracell Batteries, Pontiac GMC, Michelob, Winchester Rifles, Motorola, Campbell's Soup, Better Homes Magazine, Texaco, and Old Russian Stout Beer. And, of course, an honorable mention should go to the fact that Saturday Night Fever is playing in the upcoming dance scene, which is also directed by director John Badham. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. Yeah, that's a pretty big one this week. Once again, Brawny Paper Towels. They're one of those ones that they slip them in there like four or five times. Like, there's a commercial for Brawny. She's got Brawny on her counter in her food truck. At one point, she's using a roll of Brawny paper towels as a pillow. Brawny has definitely paid for a few of those robots in this movie. So while exploring, number five ends up being found and then lost by the security guys because it's in front of their tank, and it falls off a bridge and ends up parachuting onto the roof of Stephanie's Snack Shack, which I appreciate that the phone number is 325-4871. It's not a 555 number. I appreciate that they decided to put in a realistic phone number. 555 numbers always bug me.
The one thing I also liked about this, or thought was interesting about this movie, is that it takes place in Astoria, Oregon.
Absolutely.
Which is the same place that the Goonies takes place.
Yeah.
And so I like to imagine now that there's just this, like, combined universe where maybe Johnny Five and the Goonies eventually meet up and go on some other crazy adventure.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah, because it was one of those things that when you see her house... I was watching this one with my girlfriend, and she says, doesn't that look familiar? Like, doesn't it look like Goonies? I'm like, eh, it kind of looks like Goonies. And that's when I decided to look it up, and, oh, yeah, it's in the same place as Goonies. That would be kind of cool, though, if Johnny Five ended up finding the caves and...
Well, apparently, I think we're going to be doing this movie later on, but Kindergarten Cop also takes place in Astoria.
Yeah, I was thinking that it would be nice to finish the Astoria trilogy by doing Kindergarten Cop at some point. Stephanie is played by Ally Sheedy, who is also in Short Circuit 2 for about 5 seconds on a voice recording. She's in the movie War Games, Breakfast Club, she's having a baby, and X-Men Apocalypse?
I know, I have no idea where she is in that one, but we talked about this a little bit before we started recording. She's also in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, and just a random role as a ticket taker at the plane or whatever.
Yeah, what happened to your career, Ally Sheedy? But you had also mentioned to me before we recorded that, you know, you were curious how many people would actually recognize her in Home Alone 2. I don't know if she's that recognizable that...
Well, I don't know much about, like, even watching and seeing Steve Guttenberg, the fact that you mentioned, literally the only movie that I know him from is It Takes Two. From when I was, I don't know, 10 years old or something like that. And so that was what clicked. I was like, oh yeah, he was a big star. And then because I watched Police Academy as well, I was like, oh yeah, this guy must have been like one of the guys. And then I looked up his Wikipedia or whatever, and I think he had like 9 movies come out in 1984 or something that.
Yeah, like in the 80s, he was a franchise king. Like, I'm so surprised that he didn't come back for Short Circuit 2. And I read something that said that he actually regrets not coming back for Short Circuit 2 because they wanted him to commit without showing him a script first. Mm. So that's the only reason he didn't come back. But yeah, Cocoon 1 and 2, you know, 3 Men and a Baby 1 and 2. Like, he was trying to start all these franchises. And of course, Police Academy, like, he only did 4 of them, but they were the best 4.
Yeah, but that was the thing with Ally Sheedy is, like, I have no idea really what the landscape was. Judging from Short Circuit, I would think that she was one of the bigger... And I know she was in the Breakfast Club, I guess. So yeah, she seems like...
Dandruff one.
Yeah, she seems like she had made quite a career. Like, I would have assumed maybe she was really popular. So then to see her go, like, in the 86, and then in 92, she's just random ticket taker in Home Alone. I was trying to figure out if that was just some cameo like we do now in movies, yeah. Where it's just, haha, like, look, see this person. Or if this is legitimately just like an actor being, yeah, like, oh, I need a role, I need to work. So,
well, you know, and you also do say that everyone, or that she should have been more famous because of some of the movies that she was in. But when you actually look at the John Hughes actors, very few of them had a career much further than the 90s. Yeah. Like, they still all work. But, like, Emilio Estevez, after the Mighty Ducks movies, he sort of disappeared. Molly Ringwald, she did all her John Hughes comedies and disappeared. Michael Anthony Hall. Like, they're just all these people that everyone knows their names.
Yeah.
But they don't still get work. Yeah. Or really good work anymore.
Yeah. It's just interesting for me, I guess, going back,
yeah,
and watching these movies and have, like, now I'm kind of, like, I know who's big and who's not and that kind of stuff, but going back, it's just, you have like no idea.
And it's weird to think that Steve Guttenberg is probably still one of the biggest stars of this movie, and he was the punchline of jokes for being washed up actor for so long.
Yeah,
but he had a huge 80s career, like bigger than almost everyone else in this. Okay, so the truck now gets home and Stephanie encounters her asshole boyfriend, Frank, who is played by Brian McNamara, who was in Caddyshack 2, Arachnophobia, and so much TV, who is there to take her dog for some reason that I don't really understand. It doesn't really get explained. He says that she owes him money, but how does a three-legged dog factor into this? Like, is it just basically,
it's like kidnapping?
Yeah, is she just
for ransom?
Maybe ransom?
Like, it's either that or he's just trying to, like, stick it to her. But in this scene, we also get treated to a little gentle domestic abuse as well, which, that's wonderful. You know, I can see what you see in Frank.
It's kind of interesting also when it comes to female characters of this era, like, you always have to show, it's like a device to gain sympathy so that the audience will kind of get on their side. Like, you never see like a male character really being like abused.
And so many of the movies that we see, like, you need a damsel in distress.
Yeah, you immediately need to position her as someone who, like, needs helping.
Yeah, so that the knight in shining armor, Newton Crosby, can swoop in later. If that's really where the real love story of this movie is. But I'll get to that. That evening, Newton and Ben leave the compound to go search for number 5. Do they live in the compound? Like, why are these guys so sheltered? Newton says it's been 5 years since he's driven a truck, and obviously he's driving this thing like shit. But does he live in the compound? Like, how sheltered are these scientists? I would think that they would go home at night.
Yeah.
So maybe because it's like a secret high security, whatever it is, maybe that's why.
I also read a thing that was, I think it was one of the producers or writers, I can't remember, was talking about how he really hates that they casted Ally Sheedy and Steve Guttenberg in those roles, because they're both meant to be kind of like diminutive, you know, not assured people.
Yeah.
And Steve Guttenberg is just such the leading man, such the confident kind of alpha male, that it doesn't really fly with his
nerdy
background.
With Mahoney, where it's just this cockiness and this, like, especially Steve Guttenberg, there's a slick side to him. And yeah, all he does in this one is he pulls up his pants a little bit higher and talks in not quite as confident voice, but all his jokes are still, you know, some sick burns happening from him. Also that evening, there's a disturbance in Stephanie's truck. She thinks that Frank is back, but it's actually number 5. How'd he get off the roof?
Is that the disturbance? Him falling off the roof into the box?
Yeah, I think of the disturbance more of the fact that, like, there's lights going on inside. So, yeah, maybe I forgot that there's a crash or something that gets her attention first. But I thought it was just the shaking of the truck and the lights and all that sort of thing that got her attention. she gets to the truck, and when the window of the truck opens up, she thinks that Johnny Five is an alien because she's an idiot, and says, "I knew they'd pick me. I just knew it." Were robotics still that new in 1986 that...
Well, I mean, we're gonna get to it later, but one of the things that bothered me a little bit is, like, she thinks that number five is an alien.
Yeah.
But then, like, later on she finds out he's a robot and that he's from the Nova Corporation, and she's all, like, put off by it. Like, he's part of the system and, like, this and all this. And
yeah, she's
like, judging him because of the company's woes. And I was like, I'm sure this robot didn't demand to be created.
And you just spent an evening with this thing and loved it for the whole evening. Like, how quickly you change your mind.
After some hijinks in the truck, she finds out that number five can talk. He's voiced by Tim Blaney, who was a Muppeteer. So he did shows like Muppets Tonight, Dinosaurs. He was also Frank the Pug in Men in Black. Stephanie figures out that Forward is a way to get him to move and get him into her house, where she gives him the lamest tour ever to help quench his thirst for input. Like, she's just showing him all her animals. And, you know, hey, these are goldfish, but you can't touch those. And here's an ant farm, and it's just... If aliens actually landed on planet Earth, I hope that Stephanie is not the person that they actually find, because that would not be a good introduction to this planet. Finally, though, she shows him her encyclopedias, and number five reads through them all. They use blowing air to flip the pages for this effect. And now that he's out of books, she shows him TV. And number five stays up all night watching TV. In the morning, Stephanie takes him outside to see the sunrise. And number five ends up spooked by the dog. And he falls off the porch. And like you said, this is now where she sees the tag and realizes that he's from Nova. And he's just a robot from the warmonger company nearby. So naturally, after making some sort of bond with this robot, she instead just calls Nova to turn it in. Newton and Ben are on their way, and so is Schroeder and his army. But while waiting, number five sees a grasshopper and mimics it by jumping up and down before accidentally squishing it in the most passionate moment ever about a grasshopper. Is she that much of an animal lover that... Like, she's almost in tears over the fact that, you know, and scolding the robot. How dare you squish that grasshopper?
I grew up with a mother who refused to kill a spider.
Okay.
She always just covered it with a glass, put the paper underneath, and released it outside, so.
I'm a catch and release with spiders, too, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, a mosquito, forget it. You're dead. But something like a spider, I will catch and release. I mean, hell, right now my kids are raising caterpillars in my house. So number five puts two and two together. For someone who read all those encyclopedias, he's still pretty dumb.
Yeah, death is at D. That's pretty early on.
That was only encyclopedia number four.
But he associates the word disassemble with his dead grasshopper. So he decides to run by stealing Stephanie's truck. Why is there a driver's manual in the car? This is something like that. I think that's an actual learn how to drive driver's manual. They did the exact same thing in the movie Twins, where Arnold Schwarzenegger has to learn how to drive and there's a driver's manual in the car. Who keeps a driver's manual in their glove box?
Not like the car manual.
No, not I have to assume because he flips through this.
Children,
and now he knows how to drive.
People who have children that are studying for their learner's exam,
but in a food truck.
Yeah, and she also doesn't have kids. From what I know, so.
She's teaching all her
millions of animals how to drive, like her pet skunk. Why does she have a skunk? I don't quite understand why she has the zoo. I kind of breezed over that, but yeah, why does she have the zoo in her house?
I feel like she's running some weird But not even like an animal, like it's an animal rescue, but not as like an animal rescue that we know now, where it's where not you kind
officially.
Of a, yeah, where yeah. you find animals their forever home. It's just like a refuge for lost animals.
She just likes animals, and so she goes and abducts animals all the time. Like, I just don't understand where the skunk would have factored in.
All are welcome.
Yeah, all are welcome. No discrimination, black and white, and black and white. Yeah. That's what we'll take. So she manages to get through the back of the truck before number five takes off. But we get a car chase through town, which ends with number five almost driving off a cliff. Newton and Ben are first on the scene. Stephanie pleads with them to hear out the robot because he says he's alive. I must say, Ally Sheedy is kind of terrible at line delivery.
Fisher Stevens is probably the best overall actor in this movie.
Unfortunately.
Even Gutenberg, the very first scene when you see him, I was just like, is somebody just holding his lines up behind for him to read? Like, it was so bad. Well, and yeah, she's not.
Yeah, at first with Ally Sheedy, I thought it was because she was acting with a robot, which can't be easy. But then even when she starts interacting with Steve Gutenberg, she's just bad.
Like, but I often think that about that era of movies. I think you have to be a better actor now to be on TV than you did to have to be a high-quality movie star in the 80s and 90s. Yeah,
and then when you compare it to movies from the 70s, and, like, you know, like, you go back to movies from the 60s where everyone had the Katharine Hepburn-type delivery, almost like they were delivering for a stage production on camera. So acting has definitely evolved, but yeah, it's even some of the other 80s movies that we've watched.
It's not that bad.
It's much more solid than what Ally Sheedy is doing in this movie. Of course, before we get too far with Newton and Stephanie talking, Schroeder shows up to fuck everything up. Machines guns get fired at number five. Lasers get fired back. Eventually, Newton manages to get in front of all the bullets. Like, I don't think, even to protect an $11 million robot, I don't think I would be running in front of bullets. I can rebuild the robot.
Also, isn't it odd, like, when we first meet the robots, they're such decisive killing machines.
Yeah.
Do you not think that Johnny Five, like, why would you fire at this robot that you know has the ability to just kill you with one, like,
you were all precisely aimed laser beam? Yeah.
But through all this, they hold the fire when Newton gets out in front of him. He manages to shut down Johnny Five with the big, it's going to happen, Johnny Five or Number Five. It's going to happen all episode. But he manages to shut him down with the big red button and gets Number Five loaded onto a truck. Now, while being transported by Ben and Duke, who is played by Marvin J. McIntyre, who is in Running Man, Twins, Wagons East. He's the mortician in Back to the Future 3. I definitely remember him in that one. I just chuckled there because there's so few characters in this to introduce a character like Duke, who is in two scenes or three scenes. Basically a glorified extra. It's kind of funny to want to list credits for him. But anyway, Number Five comes back to life, but his head only? Like, why did the kill switch, this big red button, not stop his head from being paralyzed?
That's the lightning. That's the effect of the lightning.
That's what that did. Okay, so it kept some sort of low energy battery going in his head. But he manages to use what are essentially his eyelids to drop a wrench on the big red button to repower himself up. And he swaps out his shot arm for a different one. But his old arm falling off the shelf is enough to rouse the guys up front, who couldn't hear the wrench fall, but heard the arm fall. Number Five kicks them out and hijacks the truck. He realizes he has a tracking device on him, so he pulls it off and does the old switcheroo by throwing it in a passing truck. I love the old couple when they get pulled over. where the old granny is, I hope you took the grass out of the glove compartment. a joke I definitely didn't get when I was a kid.
I still don't get it now.
They have weed in the truck.
Grass.
Yeah. See, in the age of legal cannabis, it's definitely a fun joke to see. But like the little old couple, I mean, these days everyone probably smokes weed because of the legalization. I mean, we're in a country where it's countrywide legalization, but back then it's, look at the little old couple that smoke weed.
Do they explain, I'm just trying to remember, do they explain how Johnny drives?
No. Oh, well, yeah, he's got that one attachment that flips out from, like, the front of his body, and he uses
that to step on the accelerator. Well, it's kind of like a penis.
But it's like a super multifunctional, it's like a cross between a penis and, like, a Swiss Army knife or a Leatherman, you know? Because that's where all his extra little tools are. But yeah, okay. they show him stepping on the gas, because he pushes the seat out of the truck. Okay. Yeah, and then he steps on the gas with that thing. And he's a better driver in 5 minutes than Newton Crosby, Newton Crosby's only crime is not having driven for a long time. And the way he's driving, like, these trucks didn't have clutches. I don't understand how he was driving like that. I also like that when Newton ends up finding Ben and Duke sitting on the side of the road, they're throwing rocks into a cop. Yeah, like that's 1980s Angry Birds. That's what you did before a cell phone. Is well, we've got this cop. Let's just throw rocks in it and hope someone drives by. Like they weren't even expecting Newton. Like Newton just happens to drive by them.
It's like what was their plan with no cell phone and no anything? Like why weren't they walking?
Yeah, they're not hitchhiking. They're not looking for a nearby phone.
At this point, Schroeder ends up requisitioning a Huey. I like the banter between him and Howard, where it's, I thought they were called choppers. Well, now they're called Hueys. Why wasn't I notified, says Howard? Yeah, some of this banter is definitely a lot of fun. While getting ready for a bath, Stephanie is interrupted by reporters at her door. She gets rid of them, but number five has gone back to Stephanie, who is now in the bath. And tells her, nice software. And the love story begins.
Yes. Take my breath away.
Because, yeah, now we've got, like, robot boners going on. And this is where they end up dancing to the Saturday Night Fever that's playing on the TV. And Stephanie tells number five that he's such a good dancer. And I think she actually means it in this scene. But is she just humoring him? Because circles. They're just doing circles. That's all he's doing is tight circles, but she says that he's such a good dancer.
And like really jerky. I don't know if you want, but when you watch it closely, you can see that Ally Sheedy has to like bend her neck to prevent her from getting whiplash because it's like rrrn, rrrn, rrrn. It's not even like a smooth circle. No.
So number five ends up spending another night with Stephanie. I feel like they fuck. Newton, Crosby, and Ben steal a Nova truck to keep looking for number five. Howard tries to stop them, and we think he's going to run them over, but they end up escaping with this truck because they need to keep looking for number five. But they're fired. The next morning, the douchebag Frank arrives with a rifle to look for the robot because he saw Stephanie on the news the night before. And then when he sees the robot, she tells him that he has to speak robot to it. And so he says, "How, robot? Me, Frank." And no, he speaks robot, not Apache. Yikes, like I just where did this "how robot me Frank" come from? I guess from the writers of a movie that decided to make an Indian character and cast him with a white guy. I suppose I shouldn't have expected much different with a little bit of making fun of the other kind of Indians. Stephanie holds him up just long enough for number five to get away. Frank chases after him just to find that number five has completely disassembled his Firebird. It's been like 10 seconds. And he's got all the pieces laid out. How did he get that done in 10 seconds? How did he even get down the stairs in 10 seconds? like, he's got all the pieces nicely laid out on the grass out front. It's hilarious, but it's a very unrealistic time frame.
It's practically impossible.
Pissed off, Frank starts shooting at number 5, but he manages to block all the bullets because I guess he's a superhero. He tries to attack him with, was that a drive shaft? He just picks up one of the pieces of his car, and Johnny Five ends up taking it away from him, or lasering it. And so when that doesn't work, Frank goes after Stephanie, and it's number 5 to the rescue, but I practically got whiplash from how fast it goes from, like, straight up assault between Frank and Stephanie to plucky comic relief as number 5 lasers off the brim of his hat and his boot heels and his belt. Like, he pants him. That's his reaction to, like, this guy straight up, like, almost molesting Stephanie. Like, this, or, well, not molesting, but the spousal abuse that's happening. You know, it turns into a pantsing, and Stephanie just laughing at him. Like, it's a very jarring change in the tone of this movie, like, right at that moment. Yeah, Stephanie laughs at him. Frank says, "It's over, and I mean it this time," and he runs off saying he's going to call Nova. They decide to get out of there, and they call Newton Crosby for help, even though he's been fired for stealing a truck. And Howard passes on the message to Newton that she wants to meet him alone. So Ben drops him off at a bar where she is, and she tries to convince Newton that number 5 is alive. But Newton tells her he's just a piece of machinery, and then mansplains it to her like your stereo or vacuum. So while they're talking, we find out that Newton isn't the only person Howard told, because Schroeder and his soldiers are also in disguise at the bar.
At least they use stereo and not like curling iron or hair dryer or something like just really sexist.
Like your vacuum or your credit card. out behind the bar, some of the other robots have found number 5 because she hasn't actually left him anywhere safe like she told Newton that he is. And we get treated to seeing how much better a sentient robot is at strategizing compared to the mindless drones, because he dispatches them all easily by using traps and taunting them and getting them to chase after him. And then he makes one of them crash into an outhouse, and the outhouse just like straight up fucking explodes. I don't understand the science behind this outhouse exploding.
Well, you see, methane gas builds up from all the poop.
Okay.
And then it's set aflame, creating a large explosion when ignited.
And the result is shit geyser. But all the other robots get powered down by number 5 and then reprogrammed. In the bar, Newton is finally willing to give the alive robot the benefit of the doubt. And Stephanie says he's right out back. And for the second time, Schroeder fucks things up for everyone by making himself known and implying that Newton helped set this up. Number 5, having realized this is a trap, he bursts in through the wall, rescues Stephanie, and they take off. And we find out that the reprogramming that number 5 did on the other robots turned them into the Three Stooges. So I'm also wondering, where's the fourth robot? Right?
Oh, yeah.
He's number five. There were 4 other robots.
And you see a number 4 at the beginning.
Yeah, so why didn't they
send all 4 robots after him?
Maybe they knew it was a possibility that they could be compromised, so they wanted to keep one in hand.
That's a good point. There we go.
But the Three Stooges thing, I also must say, is much funnier as an adult than it was as a
child. Oh, no. Well, we're going to, like, at the end. So maybe number 4 is the decoy that ends up getting blown up later.
Because they mentioned that he built a robot.
Oh,
out of the extra parts in the truck.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's not number 4. So number 4 is still out there somewhere. and not a Three Stooge. But they could have had him and made him like Shep, because there was actually another Stooge in the later movies.
But apparently this scene, because some of the stuff for Johnny Five would take, you know, one or two puppeteers, this one, to get all three of the robots doing the Three Stooges thing, was described as a nightmare, and it took 18 puppeteers at the same time to make this little Three Stooges bit happen. So when you look at the behind the scenes stuff, extra impressive. Like, that's a lot of logistics to work out. While being chased, Stephanie is driven, and somehow Number Five comes up out of the roof to shoot lasers. This is another one where I said, how? How did he get off the roof of the truck? How did he? Because that roof is higher than he can go when he, for lack of better words, when he goes on his tiptoes. The roof is much higher, and he basically levitates out of the hatch in the roof to shoot these lasers. The logistics of how he manages to get upstairs and downstairs and into trucks and out of trucks.
Now, if they made that movie, they would use that robot from, like, that, I don't know, it's some university, and maybe it's like MIT in Boston or whatever, that one that can, like, jump and do backflips this stuff.
I've seen that. Yeah, I saw that YouTube.
But back in the day, the fact that they made him have tracks makes a lot of the up and down stuff hard to process.
I'll mention R2-D2 again. That was always something I wondered about R2-D2 was, okay, when he gets to stairs.
But then they showed he has those little rockets later that go on the side.
In the prequels, they decided to
retcon the fact that he's got these little boosters to get up places. But even BB-8 doesn't have any of those. But when he's going downstairs, you actually see, like, the thunk, clang. So he can make it work, but you never see how Number Five actually manages to get into all these impossible locations. But this is one of those ones where, okay, that roof is much taller than you are.
Yeah.
And this is just impossible. But he blocks the path with a tree by shooting it down, and they manage to get away. Ben comes back for Newton, and we find out what these socially awkward guys think about interactions with the opposite sex, because Ben is sporting quite the woody, he says.
This whole scene I found was one of the ones I logged in my mind as, like, a what the fuck moment, when Ben is talking to Newton about his experience with
Stephanie.
Yeah.
About almost touching hands.
Yeah, and then he's saying he's getting aroused just by thinking of...
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what to think. It's creepy, but also, like, kind of such an innocent...
Yeah. they're like junior high kids. That's how much of shut-ins they must be at Nova. But yeah, I wrote down a Ben line here, because, like I said, like, some of the lines he has are absolutely hilarious, which is why the idea of a character with an accent that's like a fresh off the boat type character, that's why it's so great. I just wish they had chosen something for a white guy. So I wrote down this one here where Ben says, "The cat has dragged in a sight for four eyes, that is for sure." Like, I love how often he mixes up these different metaphors and the different cliches and so that was one where he got like six different mistakes in one sentence. So it was one that I had to write down, because it's just the perfect example of the kind of lines that Ben has that are absolutely brilliant. And Fisher Stevens does such a I can't keep going back to that. So Stephanie has driven with Number Five until she runs out of gas. Now, the place where they end up, this is the Vasquez Rocks in California. Like, this is a very popular place to have in movies and TV. I know Star Trek has been there, Big Bang Theory, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. They've all been filmed. So I know these Vasquez Rocks are in California, but where are they actually supposed to be? Because I Googled it, and Astoria to the Vasquez Rocks is a 16-hour drive. So these are so clearly not something that, even if I didn't know what these were, these are so clearly not the kind of land masses that you would find in Oregon.
Well, I was saying, like, is Because I know I read that the movie is filmed in Oregon, in Astoria. But is it actually ever stated that it's there?
I think they say Oregon. Or is it Oregon ambiguous? At one point.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. But even when you see them driving and, like, they go from forests to like this desert all of a sudden, it just it seems like the environments really just don't blend together as far as I'm concerned. So she runs out of gas, and after complaining about Newton and Nova for a while and men and everything else that women be complaining about in the 80s, she goes to sleep. And number five goes back on foot to help find Newton to bring him here. So Newton is now brought to Stephanie. And then jarringly, the scene now takes place on a soundstage. When they're actually around the fire, it is so obvious that they're no longer actually outside. That is such a fake looking soundstage.
I have to go back and watch it.
But
I was fooled by the movie magic.
But, well, see, like, I get this all the time, too, because ever since seeing The Truman Show, where he ends up crashing into the wall with the ship, I now am able to see that backdrop in every other movie that tank of water has been in.
Okay.
Like, it's, because of Truman Show crashing, and then I've seen it on the Universe a lot, it's just, I can tell when they're not actually out in open water and they're on this particular tank set that is at Universal Studios. But so, yeah, Newton Crosby spends the night trying to establish whether number five is alive or not. He tries Rorschach tests, logic tests. Finally, he tells a joke that makes number five laugh like crazy, and it is an unbelievably anti-Semitic joke. Like, I heard that joke, and at first I didn't get it, and then I went, holy shit! And I had to rewind it because it's a priest, a minister, and a rabbi trying to figure out what to do with their collection money. So they draw a circle on the ground, and the priest says, okay, we'll throw all the money up in the air. Whatever lands in the circle, we give to God. And the minister says, no, whatever lands outside the circle, we'll give to God. And the rabbi says, no, we'll throw the money up in the air, and whatever God wants, he keeps. So it's just, it's this
Jews like their money.
Jews like their money joke, and...
like, it's just like, holy shit, like, this is the joke that introduces number five to comedy, introduces number five to laughing.
Next thing we know, number five is leading the, like, Fourth Reich.
Yeah, right? Like, Short Circuit 3,
Johnny Five is a racist. Like, just, oh boy, I couldn't believe that. Conclusion, this racist robot is in fact alive, is what we come to after this terrible, terrible joke. But once again, for the third time, when Newton is finally making scientific progress, Schroeder shows up to fuck everything up, and number five is left in the truck while they try to reason with the soldiers. Number five jumps out of the back of the truck and starts running away, and all the army guys blow him up. Stephanie is devastated by the loss.
This is where Ally Sheedy finally decides to become an actress.
Yeah,
she puts in a good solid, like, 1 minute of acting in this movie. Yeah, where she is devastated by his loss. Newton is trying to console her all awkwardly. And then he starts driving her home.
I love the part where they walk, like, the soldiers walk by with the head. Yeah. And they just scalped this robot. And they're just gonna put it on their mantle.
Yep.
So Newton starts driving her home, talking about how he will probably move to a ranch in Montana now that he's unemployed. Yet they didn't confiscate the truck. He stole this truck. He straight up stole this truck. and they're not confiscating it. So, like, he's not even talking about how he's going to return this truck and then go to Montana. He's just saying, no, he's going to go to Montana because he has relatives that have land there, or he's inherited land there. But twist, we find out that number five is hiding in the back. He had built a decoy, which we talked about earlier, and that's what the soldiers actually blew up. But if he's alive, shouldn't he have also felt a little guilty about creating something just for slaughter? Like, he's created this thing in his own image. Like, he's basically... He's a god of robots here. He's creating his own robot. Like, Terminator, look out, because there's going to be Johnny Fives up there fighting with your T-800s. But... I don't know, I would have thought that he'd feel a little guilty, or can he only experience humor, but he was sad about the grasshopper, wasn't he? I don't know. But even though they've all only known each other for a few days, Stephanie decides she wants to move to Montana with Newt and Crosby because 40 acres is perfect for all her animals, and number five finally gets rechristened Johnny Five. Throws out one of the ideas he throws out is Kevin Five. I definitely like Johnny Five better.
Why did he need to keep the five? He could have picked any name.
Yeah, I don't know.
I guess maybe it's his last name.
I suppose so. The thing I've always found funny, though, about the fact that he's named Johnny Five is one of the big songs that's in this movie is that Hey Johnny song.
Yeah.
And obviously that's where he gets the name from, but I am so familiar with the Weird Al, Here's Johnny, right? Like, that's one of the Weird Al songs that I know more than the actual song.
Okay.
Like, the Lola is another one. I don't know Lola, but I know all the words to Yoda, you know, things like that. So even when I hear the real song, I can't hear anything but the Here's Johnny song, and so... I just always find it funny because I hear Johnny Five or hear that song in this movie, and I just always associate it with the whole Ed McMahon thing. But then we get credits where they basically replay the entire movie in montage form, except...
There's a few extra scenes.
Well, that junkyard scene, yeah. What the fuck is that scene? I was watching this, you know, once I realized that, okay, this is just the recap of all the best moments of Johnny Five throughout the entire movie. But where would it have fit into the edit? Like, I don't even know where this scene would have fit in the movie, whatever is happening in this junkyard.
Yeah, I can't, because he's fighting, like, the evil robots or something.
Yeah, and there's the part where he, like, avoids being crushed in a car or something, and there's another down a wire.
There's another part where he's, like, talking to this other robot that was also cut, but you can see it. They play it in the...
Oh, yeah.
It's like a Herbie robot,
yeah,
almost.
One of the toy or Tommy robots.
Yeah. They play that one in the credits, too. I felt like... That was an interesting way to cap off the movie. And I was trying to think...
By re-showing the movie?
Yeah, I was trying to think, I wonder if they should start doing that again.
Yeah.
Except movies now are like 3 hours long, so it'd be a little bit tougher, but...
Well, and we talked about... Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they could recap everything and then put the Marvel bonus scene in for Marvel movies. But I know that this is also a scene, like that junkyard scene, it's very similar to a scene that is actually in Short Circuit 2, which is part of the reason where I say at the beginning, I sometimes blend the two movies together, and this is one where you actually look at this and go, wait, but that's kind of in Short Circuit 2, because there's like a scene on a shipyard with similar things happening, but that is Short Circuit. Now, on IMDb, it scored 6.7 out of 10, and it had a Metascore of 50. On Rotten Tomatoes, it had an audience score of 67, and a critic's freshness rating of 58%. Did you find anyone else that had something to say about it? Because these are just numbers. What did people say about Short Circuit, Colin?
Let's go to the critics. So, Variety said, scripters get credit for some terrific dialogue, which is a very questionable, like, positive review, that would have been a lot less disarming if not for the winsome robot and Shi's affection for it. Gutenberg plays his best goofy self. The New York Times said, "The movie, which has the clean, well-scrubbed look of an old Disney comedy, is nicely acted by Miss Sheedy, who demonstrates a light comedy touch, not unlike Amy Irving's and Mr. Gutenberg."
Well, I have to disagree with that one, that's for sure.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert both hated the movie. Siskel said, "The film has nowhere to go except to give us a predictable initial confrontation between Gutenberg and Sheedy over military weapons." And Ebert said, "It's basically a kid's movie, and quite possibly the kids will like it, but they'll have to be fairly young kids." And then probably my favorite review that I read comes from Rotten Tomatoes user Eric M. He wrote this in June of this year. He says, "Fuck E.T. This has more heart and is a lot more interesting. So what if it is predictable? Don't make it a bad movie." And that's the critics.
Nice. You know, what's funny is I actually read something that there was an original cut of this movie, and when it was screened to test audiences, everyone got kind of upset because there was, like, more of a love story going on between Stephanie and Johnny Five. Like, she was more affectionate towards him. That, and, like, when I said that, you know, did they fuck?
Yeah.
In the original cut, they might have, or might have been very insinuated.
There's another Rotten Tomatoes user review that I read that literally just says, "Abused woman wants to fuck robot." And it didn't really resonate with me at the time, but as we've talked about it and I'm starting to remember the movie a little bit more, I can see it.
Yeah. Go Gadget Dildo. So we've got kind of mid-60s from audiences and kind of 50s from critics. So, I don't know, where does it fall for you?
Hi, man. This movie is tough for me. It's not a movie I would ever watch again. I have no nostalgia for it, so I don't really feel like... Yeah, it's just kind of an artifact of its time. I would give it a 50. I wouldn't rate it that high. I think it's too basic, and even though it seems like kind of an original concept, I've just seen too many things now.
Well, it does and it doesn't. Like, if you really boil it down to the fact that it's basically Frankenstein with a robot.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that original of a concept, and for me it's a lot slower than I remember.
Yeah, like, it's not a very long movie.
Yeah,
but it feels like it could have been accomplished in half an hour.
Well, yeah, because of the fact that you look at the robot tries to convince her it's alive, Newton Crosby shows up, and then Schroeder fucks everything up, and that happens three times in the movie. So it's, you know, like, all three acts of the movie, the same storyline happens in every single one of the acts. I think I have more fondness for Short Circuit 2 now that I think about the things that happened in this one. I think Short Circuit 2 was the one that I liked. And I guess every franchise needs the origin story.
Yeah.
So, you know, Short Circuit, this is the origin story, whereas with Short Circuit 2, we can just jump right in.
Yeah, but I could see that. I think, yeah, looking at this movie, there's more to go for Johnny Five onward. You know what I mean? Which is kind of crazy to me that there was only two movies.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought Johnny Five as a character itself could have easily done, like, six kids movies.
Yeah,
it could have been one of those types of franchises, like Police Academy, where it just goes on forever.
Cartoon series. They could bring it back as a Netflix show these days. I mean, Ben is hilarious, and he was a great guy to have as a second. Like, all the problematic elements aside, he was a much better choice to be the lead of the second movie and giving the world more Ben.
Yeah.
But you also wonder what it would have been like if Steve Gutenberg had signed on too.
Yeah. I think it would be amazing for them to reboot this movie and have Aziz Ansari play the role of Ben.
Or, well, no, be Ben's son.
Or be Ben's son.
Yeah, yeah, that would be a better way to do it. Like, let's, we don't want to ignore the fact that
Ben has to be dead, though. He cannot show up.
Yeah, we can't ignore the fact that Ben existed, but yeah, no cameos for Fisher Stevens. Fisher Stevens, I love you. You are a very talented performer. You know, and when you look at this, like, the first one's 86. I think the second one was 89. And if he's giving interviews in 91 where this stuff didn't even faze him, yeah, they had plenty of potential to carry on with a trilogy or further and still use Ben at that time. You still use Fisher Stevens at that time, but
they had till about, I feel like they could have got away with him playing that role to about, I'm going to say 2001.
Probably.
Yeah. Easy.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. Right down the middle. I still enjoyed it, and the lines that Ben had, like the quick quips, the banter, I caught so much more of it as an adult than the last time I saw it. And so I did find a lot of funnier moments than I would have as a kid. But
yeah. I'd actually equate, this movie was very similar to Neverending Story for me in terms of, I think as a kid it was unwatchable to me, I think because it was so slow.
Yeah.
Like, what I've found as we started watching more of these movies is, like, all I remember is the action and the fighting.
Yeah.
And there was, like, none of that in either of those movies. Yeah. And so,
or the funny lines.
Or the funny lines, yeah.
I guess the catchphrase lines. Because the lines that I found funny watching it this time wouldn't have been, you know, when I was a kid, it was Johnny Five is alive. And and I remember also being, like, an eight-year-old kid, and this was one of those first movies that I saw that had the word shit in it.
Ooh.
You know, because the shit, where's shit? I don't see shit, and it was absolutely hilarious to be able to see this movie. But now, even watching it this time, I didn't realize all the other swears that were in this movie. but there's so much highlight on that one shit line. That's the one that stood out for me as a kid. So that's Short Circuit, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, oh boy, you know what you could do? You could go over to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. Doesn't really matter what you said. We're not trying to build our egos here, but if you just give us those 5 stars in a review, it just helps drive us up the charts, helps us get noticed.
And check out our website, www.IUsedToLikeThisOne.com. There you'll find links to our social medias. We have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can email us at IUsedToLikeThisOne@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the show. Like, subscribe, comment, do everything you can to help us out.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on
I Used to Like This One.